The ground sometimes shakes and volcanoes sometimes erupt. You know from past experience that those events are connected, but you might be a little unclear on just how. We have just the person to ask. Dr. Stephen McNutt at the University of South Florida is a seismologist who studies volcanoes. He's made some discoveries in recent years with the help of modern technology and active volcanoes. Dr. McNutt speaks at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay Saturday night at 7 at the Hale Center. The title, we're not making this up, Shaking and Baking, Using Seismology to Study Volcanoes. Steve McNutt, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, give us an idea of, I mean, is this unusual for seismologists to study volcanoes? Is it a fairly recent development?
No, I think seismology has been at the heart of volcano observatories since about 1911, when the Hawaii volcano first started, and Vesuvius in Italy and some places in Japan. So it was recognized for years, centuries, that there were sometimes earthquakes that were felt prior to volcanic eruptions. And so in the olden days, people didn't know if there was a difference between earthquakes and volcanoes. In fact, there was an old theory that earthquakes, all earthquakes, were underground volcanoes.
Ah, which is not the case as we know now, right?
No. So at volcanoes nowadays, we look at the specialized small earthquakes that occur under volcanoes. The ones that are of most interest are the ones that occur just prior to eruptions.
And are they reliable enough from volcano to volcano to give you some indication of what might happen in that eruption?
There's a couple schools of thought. I try to look for similarities and figure out what the process, when you have a certain type of signal, what's the process, and then how does that process work at different volcanoes. There's another school of thought that every volcano has its own unique signature, its own personality, and you can only use information on that volcano to look at that particular volcano again. That works if you have a previous eruption. Where the problem comes in is if you get a new volcano that has never erupted and it starts to go, what's your basis? I think you have to generalize from prior observations elsewhere.
I know from talking to geologists in the past, we've learned a few things about the different kinds of flows that come out of volcanoes, and so there are some differences, the different types of volcanoes, certainly. I mean, are they distinctive enough that eruptive material from one volcano or the way in which the ground moves around it are unique enough to be like a fingerprint for that volcano?
There's a little bit of that. I mean, the interesting thing is if you take the same magma, if it ascends rapidly from deep in the crust up to the surface, the gases stay trapped inside, and then you get an explosive eruption. You can take that same magma and have it move up slowly, the gases escape, and you'll get a gentle lava flow. So one of the critical things then is the ascent rate, and we can tell something about that from using seismology.
All right. So how is this? I know you mentioned something about volcano laboratories when you were coming on, and I know you worked at the Alaska Volcano Laboratory for a while, which was apparently developed after an eruption there.
Yeah. Alaska Volcano Observatory was founded in 1988, and it got a real boost about a year later. Mount Readout erupted, and it sent up an ash cloud that drifted about 350 kilometers north, and all four engines got put out on a KLM 747 aircraft. Descended about 12 minutes, I think it was, and then was able to restart two engines and do an emergency landing. So then the AVO got a boost, and when I got up to Alaska in 1991, I think there were stations on five or six volcanoes, and at the peak about 15 years later, there were stations on 30 volcanoes. So it was a rapid expansion. We learned a lot from that effort and were able to correctly forecast and monitor a whole range of volcanoes.
So 30 volcanoes just in Alaska or scattered around the world?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
No,
really?
30 just in Alaska. There's 52 volcanoes in Alaska that have had historical activity and roughly 80 overall. So the 30 was approaching the halfway point.
Wow. So you know, we can't ever assume, I guess, as we learned with Mount St. Helens 35 years ago, that a volcano dormant is going to stay dormant. I mean, given that we live in a part of the world here on the West Coast where there are volcanoes in various states of sleepiness, I mean, can we assume they're going to stay sleepy, or could there be further activity in any of them? Crater Lake, Mount McLaughlin, Mount Shasta, any of them?
Yeah, I think we have to consider all of them as being potentially active. There's 17 major cascade peaks and a bunch of smaller peaks. If you look historically, you know, we have geologic evidence in the form of deposits from past eruption. The intervals between eruption are most commonly on the order of hundreds of years. And what I don't know of, and I don't think there is evidence that says any of them have permanently gone to sleep. So that means that molten rock is continuing to form underground, And when conditions are right, they could erupt again.
Okay, so give us an idea of how limited our understanding is and how far it has come along, given the fact that technology seems to be advancing by great degrees every day. First of all, it's not like we have dirt submarines or something so we can really plunge into the earth to get a real good look up close at what happens down there. So there must be limits there, but give us a context of that. I mean, how much we still don't understand about what's going on down below.
Yeah, so seismology is a form of remote sensing. You're right. The part we're most interested is down there under our feet, many miles down. We don't know exactly what's there. So we use two different types of approaches. One is we try to see what happens when a seismic wave passes through the region under a volcano. So the earthquake can be local, say within 20 miles or so, or it can be distant. As long as the seismic waves travel under the volcano and arrive at a station in the vicinity of the volcano, then we know enough about how seismic waves transmit through the crust and through rocks that we can infer what's down there. This is a technique that's used to figure out the layers of lava flows versus tephra or ash, and then figure out where the magma bodies are if they're there. So that's one approach. The second approach is to examine the natural earthquakes that occur under volcanoes, and that's the bulk of what I do. So there's a background rate of usually a few events per day or a few per week, and then the rates and the types of events often change and increase dramatically prior to eruptions. So there we learn more about the physics of how magma moves in the shallow crust. And it makes a difference if it's been a long time since the previous eruption, then the crust is cold and probably saturated with water. And if it's been a recent time since eruption, say, you know, with Mount St. Helens, for example, had erupted a couple decades ago, then the crustal rocks in the upper part of it are still hot and still partly plastic, so the mechanics of moving magma are a bit different there than it would be if the crust is cold. So we sort of exploit these sort of generic ideas about how magma moves and how the physics work when rock breaks to figure out what's going on, how much magma is there, and where it's moving.
Stephen McNutt is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a seismologist who studies volcanoes at the University of South Florida and elsewhere. He'll be speaking at SWOC, Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay, for the geology lecture series Saturday night at 7 at the Hales Center in Coos Bay. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 with questions and comments about volcanoes and seismology, or you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So now to the technology. I have to believe that there have been enough advancements in enough fields that seismology has probably had a few things that are available to you now that weren't, say, 15 years ago.
Yeah, so one of the big ones, there's been an increase in instrumentation. The main thing happened 20 or so years ago, a new class of instruments that are able to stay on scale for a wide range of frequencies and sizes. Prior to that, we had sensitive instruments, but when you had a big earthquake, they go off scale. Now we're able to keep on scale. And then second, they look at a wide frequency range. So in the past, we would think that the energy was all 5 or 10 hertz, 5 or 10 cycles per second. Now we see that there's these fairly extraordinary signals that have periods of like 10 or 20 seconds and are very small, shallow events occurring right under the volcano. So that's on the instrument side that's sitting out there on the volcano. And then the other big change is in the lab. The horsepower of computers has gone up dramatically. And there's a lot of techniques, digital processing techniques, available now in the lab that we didn't used to be able to do, and that's where we're able to dissect some fairly precise measurements from our data that we didn't used to even be aware of.
So the acoustic studies that you do of volcanoes, you actually have microphones that are listening for seismic activity down below?
Yeah, so the acoustic part, we call it infrasound. It's below the human threshold of hearing, so humans can hear down to about 20 hertz or 20 cycles per second, and infrasound kicks in below that, so mostly from about from zero up to 20 hertz. And so it's complementary to seismology. So when an explosion occurs at a volcano, the explosion pounds on the ground and we get seismic waves which propagate out and are recorded on our seismic stations. At the same time, you get a sound wave in the air which travels more slowly, but it shows up on the acoustic instrument. So they're a type of microphone. They're generally called infrasound sensors. They're like a low-frequency microphone, specially calibrated. Like it wouldn't be very good at recording somebody singing or playing the guitar, but it would be good for the low frequency sounds.
And obviously the kinds of thing we can't hear, as you mentioned, because it's below our threshold. But are there things we can feel? I mean, I've often heard people talk about, well, you want to get the bass speakers down to 20 hertz, because even if you can't hear it, you can feel it.
Yeah, some of the stronger signals you definitely feel. Over the years, I've been at some volcanoes that have had explosions which made shock waves, which were enough to make the windows rattle, and you can feel it very clearly. Also, I was out in the field one time when some guys from the military had to come and dispatch some old ordnance left over from World War II. So what they did is they blew it up, and believe me, you could feel the shock wave from that. From a half mile away, it scared the hell out of us.
No doubt. So is there one thing about volcanoes above all others that fascinates you and keeps you glued to the work year after year?
It's sort of a mystery, or it's really interesting how the molten rock worms its way up to the surface and erupts. I mean, it's one of the most dynamic processes in the earth sciences, and the scale of it can be huge. You know, the Yellowstone examples popped up occasionally. There's nothing imminent happening at Yellowstone, but if you look at what it's done historically, three times in the past 2 million years, it's had these enormous eruptions that covered something like a third of the country with ash. And this all happens on a scale of, you know, a couple of days. So that's mind-boggling, to have cubic kilometers of material come erupting out of the earth and go into the atmosphere and have global effects. I don't know, it's a really dynamic and interesting process. So we're plugged in at the more practical level of trying to understand the small scale place. You know, one of those super eruptions, the problem from a scientific point of view is I don't know where you'd put your instruments because they would be destroyed and there wouldn't be a safe place within hundreds of miles to watch it. So it's a funny thing and paradoxical, right? When the most interesting thing is happening, you lack the ability to see it.
No, I hadn't thought about that. The obliteration of everything that you're trying to measure it with would be an issue. There was something I was reading in your work indicating that there's something like long-distance calls between volcanoes and seismic activity, and it had to do with Mount Wrangell in Alaska and an earthquake in the Andaman Islands 11,000 kilometers away. I mean,
so this is pretty wild. This is the Sumatra earthquake, the one on Christmas Day 2004. When that earthquake occurred, it sent waves all over the earth, and some of the long-period surface waves took 45 minutes or something to get there. The ground was moving up and down about a centimeter in Alaska from an earthquake 11,000 kilometers away, which by itself is extraordinary. There's a huge amount of power in these things. So what would happen then at Wrangell, when the ground moved up and reached the top of its cycle, a small earthquake occurred at Wrangell. And then a half minute later, the ground would have gone down and then moved back up, and it triggered a second one. This happened 14 times. So we had these 14 small earthquakes at Wrangell that were triggered by the long period surface waves from this earthquake in Sumatra, which is pretty mind-bending.
It is. It's a very, very long way away. And while we're in the mind-bending area, let's talk about volcano lightning. This is a really interesting thing, too.
Yeah, so lightning occurs, of course, in ordinary thunderstorms, and it's fairly common in volcanoes. I say fairly common. For years, you would see people would show a photograph at a conference or a cover of a book or something to be a volcanic eruption with lightning, but it was never treated in the way of scientific data. It was sort of anecdotal or, you know, pretty picture. So we recorded, when I was still in Alaska, we recorded lightning in association with an eruption at Mount Spur, and wrote it up and submitted it for publication. And then along the way of doing that research, I just started looking around, finding occurrences of lightning at other volcanoes and just documenting it. And this was everything from, you know, billboards at national parks in Japan to a magazine picture in the background for some advertisement to scientific reports where it was added as an afterthought. And it turns out lightning had occurred at something like 150 now, 150 volcanoes with hundreds, if not thousands, of occurrences. And this has sort of escaped much in the way of scientific scrutiny, and now it's become a fairly active research field.
All right. Sounds really interesting. We have an email here from Ned in Phoenix, who says, I've read the book Fire and Ice Cascade Volcanoes by Stephen Harris. The book goes through the Cascades from B.C. to Lassen Peak. The last chapter was a scenario with Mount Shasta erupting, which was quite interesting, especially with I-5 tracking on its western flank and Lake Shasta in the flow zone. Shasta is theoretically overdue based on the periods you mentioned a few minutes ago. Are we with Shasta in its window now?
It's not that exact. I think Shasta has been, I believe it's about 600 years since its last eruption, which is a pretty long time. And so if the interval is about that, then you would say, yeah, it's in its interval. But the trouble is there's variance in all these things. In other words, it's not exactly periodic. And the lacking a sophisticated model or an exact way to say what the period ought to be, yeah, we're within some vague window, but it's there's nothing imminent. The seismicity is all at the background level. There's nothing that suggests it's has anything out of the ordinary happening right at this time.
Okay, all kinds of things going on in the natural world all the time, but not immediately at Mount Shasta, as we're hearing. Dr. Stephen McNutt is at the University of South Florida. He'll be giving the geology lecture Saturday night at 7 at the Hale Center at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay. I am not making up the title, Shaking and Baking, Using Seismology to Study Volcanoes. Dr. McNutt, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
You're very welcome.
All right, take care.